Good morning. It's 9:06 on Monday, January 4th, the first Monday of the new year. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn one more time on the Ideas Network. Well, this being 9 o'clock on Monday morning, that means it's all things political. We'll spend the hour talking about the political news of the past week, and in spite of the holiday, there was plenty of it. My guest this morning is Mike Madden, Salon.com's Washington correspondent. Good morning, Mike, and welcome to the program. Oh, Mike, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, I'm pretty good so far, but the day is young. Can you hear me?
Yes, yes. Just wanted to make sure you could hear me.
Yes, and I can hear you, so we have a show. Always a good idea. Well, lots of political news in spite of the holidays. National security suddenly knocking health care off the front page, so to speak. There's a lot going on, and of course, anytime there's an event, it becomes instantly political. Let's talk about some of the political fallout. Going back to the attempted bombing of the Delta flight coming into Detroit at Christmas, we're still getting fallout from that. It was all over this Sunday morning news programs. Let's start by talking about that issue.
Well, yeah, you know, you would think that the week between Christmas and New Year's, with Congress and the president all out of town, should have been pretty slow week politically, but it obviously turned out that it wasn't. The administration is still being criticized both politically and on policy grounds for the way that that incident was handled. You've had Republicans accusing them of being soft on terror, and simultaneously you've got sort of policy experts saying that in fact some of the policies may have been a little soft on terror, and I think they're still trying to sort of scrambling to show that they're at ahead of what's happening with aviation. And so they rolled out a whole bunch of new policies for screening passengers from terrorism-prone nations and random pat-downs and searches on other passengers on international flights. So it's we could still see some more changes with aviation security over the next few weeks, too.
Deputy National Security Advisor John Brennan made the rounds of the Sunday morning talk shows yesterday, and there was a part of the breaking news over the weekend, the closing of the embassies in Yemen in response to increased terror threats there, and it appears now that some of the prisoners who had been released from Guantanamo back to Yemen are now back in the terrorism fight, a little resurgence for al-Qaeda. That can't be good news for the Obama White House.
No, it would seem as though it's not. Although, administration officials have been pretty careful to point out that several of the players in Al Qaeda in Yemen were released before they took office. It's not as if they all got out of Guantanamo over the last year. But it does sort of raise some questions and perhaps lead to some vulnerability about the entire direction of their counterterrorism policies, which and the whole notion of closing Guantanamo for good and shifting people into more conventional criminal justice systems. This sort of makes it easier for opponents of that decision to say that there will be negative fallout from it.
Yeah, and there was discussion, a number of people going on the record over the weekend, including, I believe, the Democratic chair of the House committee that deals with national security issues, kind of sparring with the Republican leadership on that very issue. And then the other thing was that I noticed, and this comes under the file, I think. Democrats were pointing out that when the famous shoe bomber tried to bring down a plane over the Atlantic, that President Bush was on vacation and that it was weeks before he really had any official comment on it. And Republicans were quite silent on those issues at that time, even after it was revealed that there were a whole lot of weaknesses in their security plan as well.
Right. This was one of the criticisms that I found a little bit less persuasive. I mean, it wasn't entirely clear what good it would have done to have the president out on Christmas Day, as the story was developing, saying something vague about an attack that essentially only vaguely materialized. Certainly there. That's one of the criticisms, is that the administration was slow to declare it an act of terrorism and slow to get out ahead of it and be reassuring about it. But and of course, when they did put out some people, Janet Napolitano, put her foot in her mouth the weekend right after Christmas, saying that the system had worked. So that's going to continue to be some of the back and forth. But I think some Democrats may be hoping that the Republicans will overreach on this. I mean, you had some Republicans trying to raise money over the last week with references to the attempted bombing, and that seems to be sort of beyond the pale for most people's definition of political standards of discourse.
I want to give the phone number and invite people to join our discussion. It's All Things Political for this first Monday of the new year, and we're talking about political news over the past week, and in spite of there being a holiday in there, in fact, we've had 2 weeks with holidays in them, we've had plenty of political news generated. Of course, that's not probably too surprising, considering that we're running up to a midterm election in the fall of this year, but lots of news to talk about, and wondering what you think about some of the political stories. What about the politicization of terrorism? And we have seen it before. It's not a new thing. What do you think about it? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234 is the toll-free number. If you would prefer, you can use email, and the address is talk@wpr.org. I'm talking with Mike Madden, who is Salon.com's Washington correspondent. Well, one of the other things that came up in my survey of political news online, Politico ran a story talking about, you know, how vulnerable Democrats are going to be in the midterm elections. Of course, that's been discussed quite a bit over the last few months. But the other story, other side of that story, was a little bit of talk about how Republicans may not have the funding they need to take advantage of a perceived Democratic weakness. Let's talk about both of those issues. How tough a year does it look to be for Democrats in Congress? Are they going to lose their majorities?
Well, it's hard to say now exactly how tough it's going to be. I mean, you know, historical trends would tell you that they'll certainly lose some seats in both houses. Losing the majority, I think, would be difficult. Just in the Senate, for instance, you know, they've got obviously 58 or 60 votes, depending on how you count people like Bernie Sanders and Joe Lieberman. And the map sort of slightly favors Democrats this cycle in terms of whose seats are up. I think there aren't as many obvious opportunities for seats to switch hands as you might need there to be in order to pick up 10 seats if you're the Republicans. In the House, I think it may be a little bit closer, but again, they have a fairly large majority because of the scale of the Democratic victories in the last two elections in 2006 and 2008. But they'll certainly lose seats. I mean, I don't think there's anyone in politics who doesn't expect reasonably serious losses. And, you know, the mantra coming out of Democratic political operatives over the last year has always been, if the election were held today, then maybe it would be really bad, but we don't know what things are going to be like when the election actually comes around. And even though the election is now a little bit closer, I think that still remains the case. I mean, if the economy, which is starting to show some signs that it may begin recovering, if it continues on that path and gets a little bit better, and if the administration is able to point to, some accomplishments on the jobs front and the domestic economy front over the course of the year, then that may mitigate the losses a little bit. On the other hand, if things remain stalled and if people don't feel as though there's been a much of a tangible improvement in their lives, then I think things, you know, the losses could be heavier than even the most pessimistic Democrats are expecting now.
What issues are the most troublesome for Democrats as they try to defend their seats?
Well, there's a lot of anxiety that polling is picking up among independent voters about the deficit and about sort of the fiscal health of the nation. Setting aside the healthcare fight, which has been obviously the most contentious issue over the last year, but which is likely to be resolved soon, so we won't still be hanging around by election time. There's just a great sense that the country is on an unsustainable financial course right now with the amount of money that we're having to borrow in order to fund things like healthcare, like the stimulus package, like just the general operation of the government with tax revenues falling due to people's income falling. And I think, you know, there's been talk that Congress will soon roll out some deficit reduction proposals, I think you can expect to see some serious efforts to regain that kind of financial stewardship label that the Democrats had done a pretty good job of taking from Republicans during the Bush years, and which now all of a sudden they seem to be at risk of losing back again. And I think that's probably the number one issue. Healthcare may continue to linger a little bit as an issue. You may have some especially some vulnerable Democrats who are forced to defend the bill even if they don't vote for it. And in some districts that may be a better issue than others. You know, you may have places where Republicans are able to say, look what they've done to the healthcare system, and you know that they're going to be increasing taxes on this and that, and you don't even get any benefits for several years. So I think that's something to be concerned about. And then also, of course, the war in Afghanistan, which has been, you know, U.S. is committing substantially more resources there, and it's unclear how long that's going to be something that people are willing to support. And you know, if casualties continue to be sustained at a high rate, then that could become a political issue for the elections as well.
Well, what about when President Obama was elected, the last election? I mean, there were a lot of people who participated for the very first time in an election, and they were energized. They really got out and they voted in large numbers, and they really made a difference for President Obama and for the Democratic Party. Are those voters going to be going back to the polls in 2010 and voting in the same kinds of numbers that they voted for in the presidential election? And does that work for or against the Democrats?
That may be the biggest issue. The biggest issue that Democrats are worried about is the extent to which those first-time voters show up. And, you know, there is definitely increasing concern that they may not, that the Democrats haven't necessarily given them much of a reason to. You know, Obama won't be on the ballot himself, although I'm sure that he will be campaigning pretty heavily, especially in areas where Democrats won seats largely on the strength of what people are calling Obama surge voters. You think of someone like Representative Tom Perriello in Southern Virginia near Charlottesville and sort of some of the rural parts of Virginia near there, and he won his seat by a very small number of votes, and it's hard to imagine that he would have won if not for the new voters in his district coming out. So you can expect to see an emphasis on putting the president in those areas. But midterm elections historically have much lower turnout than presidential elections, and especially when we have a presidential election that was, you know, the most widely participated in quite some time, it's going to be difficult to sustain that same type of intensity. And right now, a lot of political observers think the intensity is actually on the Republican side, that the Republican base is fired up and angry about what the administration is doing, and they're ready to come out and say something about it, whereas the Democratic base maybe isn't as fired up, in part because legislating involves compromises, and some of the compromises have not been that popular with the people that helped get Obama elected.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll continue our discussion on all things political this Monday morning. My guest is Mike Madden, Washington correspondent for Salon.com. And we'd both like to hear from you what your take is on all of this. If you were going to vote today, if the 2010, the fall election was today, what would you be doing in the voting booth? Would you be voting for your incumbent member of Congress or not? And why or why not? Call in and let us know what you think about that. What kind of political issue do you think healthcare is going to be? The economy, government spending, all of those things. Or are there some local issues that are much more important to you? Are you more concerned with what's going on in state politics here in Wisconsin? Call and let us know about that as well. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's the toll-free number to join the program. Works pretty much anywhere you can hear the program. Or you can use our email, which is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Kathleen will be back tomorrow. well-rested and all that, ready to go. Here's what's coming up a little bit later on today on At Issue with Ben Marins. The current recession doesn't just affect mom and dad, but kids, too. On At Issue after 4, Ben Marins and his guests discuss how to talk with your children about the recession and what it means to your family. That's coming up later this afternoon on the Ideas Network. This hour, it's all things political, and my guest is Mike Madden, Washington correspondent for Salon.com. We were talking about party politics going into the 2010 elections, and we were talking, focusing mainly on the Democrats and the problems they were going to have, but there are some Republican issues here, too, and one of them that's come up recently, there are two of them that have come up recently. One is sort of a division among the base. You've got the teabaggers, as they're sometimes called. People have been, whoa, what happened there? I think we just lost Mike Madden. Well, the vagaries of the phone system. We'll get Mike back in just a moment. In the meantime, how about if I give the phone number again and ask for a little more participation from you? We've got several calls lined up. We'll be taking those in just a moment. But 800-642-1234 is the toll-free number, 800-642-1234. You can also send an email. The address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Our program, of course, 9 o'clock on Monday morning, is all things political. Mike, we have you back now, I understand.
You do, yes.
Okay. Well, as I was saying before we got cut off, we were talking before the break about some of the Democratic problems going into the 2010 elections. But the Republicans have some issues of their own, one of them being some division within their own party between the Tea Party folks and more what are now being called more mainline Republicans. And some, you know, the Tea Party folks don't think the Republicans in Congress have been conservative or active enough, and that may be an issue for them. Some are calling for a third party. Some are just irritated. And what will they do in the fall? That would be one. The second one, and this was a story that I first saw yesterday afternoon, which is there is some concern by Republican congressional strategists that they won't have enough money to mount an effective campaign in the fall. Let's talk about both of those issues for just a moment, and then we'll take some phone calls as they're lining up for us. What about the divisions in the Republican base, and is that going to be a factor by fall, or will they be able to patch things up?
Yeah, I think that will continue to be a factor. I think that the Republicans have a good opportunity to pick up some seats, but they will, they may be stepping on their own feet on the way there because there's a handful of districts already and some Senate races where very conservative challengers are attempting to win the nominations from people that are sort of more moderate and seen as being somehow disloyal to Republican values. The problem becomes in the general election that if you nominate someone who is an ideological purist, I think the last several years have shown that kind of Republican, extreme conservative Republican doesn't necessarily do so well among independent voters. So something like Florida, where the governor, Charlie Crist, is running for the Senate and is being pursued doggedly by a conservative challenger named Marco Rubio, grassroots conservative activists are very excited about Rubio, but it may well be that when it comes time to the general that he's just too conservative for the voters of Florida, who are really not, the kind of fire-breathing anti-government activists that the Republican primary electorate is. And I think that's something that will be fascinating to watch over the course of the year is whether Republicans are able to kind of moderate some of their own impulses or whether they continue on this path towards getting more and more conservative, even as they have the chance to pick up some swing seats.
What about the financial issue? The story over the weekend that's saying that right now the Republicans really only have enough money to put on one congressional race, and they have a whole bunch of them to prepare for. How big a factor is that likely to be?
Well, that could certainly be a factor. Fundraising could obviously improve. I mean, they have some time before they have to worry, really go into a panic mode. But no, certainly, it doesn't matter how many seats you might have the opportunity to pick up if you can't fund the races there. And I think, you know, we certainly saw over the course of both Barack Obama's campaign and also Howard Dean's campaign in 2004 that it can be possible to raise large amounts of money on the internet fairly quickly. You know, and on the Republican side, Ron Paul did the same thing. But if I were a Republican strategist, I don't know that I would want to be banking, no pun intended, on suddenly being able to turn on a spigot of online support. I mean, I think they need to sort of figure out why they haven't been raising money and see what they can do about improving that trend if they're going to put that worry behind them.
Somebody, and I forget which writer pointed this out, I read so many different articles getting ready for this show, I'm trying to remember which one's which, but it doesn't really matter. The point was that in 1994, the Republicans were outspent by the Democrats, and they still managed to win.
That's true. And, you know, money isn't everything, but it certainly it goes a long way in terms of, I mean, where sort of a financial gap can be maybe most helpful or most problematic is where, you know, it's not so much on the seats that you're expecting to win. It's on having the opportunity to expand the playing field a little bit. And you know, if you're the Republicans, put the Democrats on the defense in districts that they weren't planning to contest. And it's sort of, you know, the more races you can turn competitive, the likelier your chance of picking up more seats is. So if you don't have money to play with, it's harder to sort of change the map. I mean, you know, one of the things that Obama's campaign did very well during the presidential race last year, because of their massive financial advantage over John McCain, was they were able to compete in states that Democrats typically don't do well in, and you know, several of them they won, like North Carolina and Indiana and Virginia. But you know, even just dumping a little bit of money into something like Georgia, which they did at some point, sort of forced the McCain people to react to that instead of letting them drive the strategic decisions of the campaign the way that they might have wanted to. So that may be where Republicans really feel the lack of a powerful financial base, is if they find themselves kind of unable to expand the map beyond what sort of the obvious seats are.
Everyone's assuming that the Democrats are going to lose seats in the 2010 midterm election, which actually I suppose that's redundant. Is there a scenario under which they could actually gain seats?
I mean, I'm sure there is. You know, they could certainly gain. They could pick up some of the Senate seats. You know, they could hold all of their Senate incumbents and maybe pick up one or two seats. I'm not quite as familiar yet with all of the contested House races to know how likely that is. But, you know, just looking at some of the seats that Democrats hold now after the last two election cycles, it seems hard to imagine that they can increase their majority in the House. I mean, they have seats in the House. For instance, this New York 23 seat that was the subject of a special election in November. I mean, it's been more than 100 years since a Democrat had that seat, and I think the Democrats may be up at the point where they've pretty much got every seat that the current political boundaries really put within their grasp. So it's hard to see them significantly expanding their House majority.
Well, let's take some phone calls. We have callers lined up and ready to go. We'll start with Amy in Green Bay first. Amy, good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to take a minute to say that I will still be voting for my local representative in the 2010 election. Steve Kagan, Democrat, is my representative, and I think that he has a really unique opportunity, being that he is a doctor, to kind of deal with these health care issues that are coming up.
Amy, thanks for the comment. I just wanted to ask you a question. I mean, you're Green Bay, that whole Fox Valley area has traditionally been a fairly conservative and Republican stronghold. Why do you think Steve Kagan was able to get elected in the first place? And just talking to friends and people on the street in Green Bay, how widespread do you think his support is going to be this fall?
I'm actually originally from Coleman, which is about 7 miles away from John Gard's hometown. John Gard being the big competitor for Steve Kagan in the last couple elections, and I just don't think that he has the political clout in the bigger cities that he does up north, and I don't think that he really has the access to take that up. I think that Steve Kagan has a lot of clout in this area, and I think that he's going to be in his seat for quite a while longer.
All right. Thank you, Amy. Mike Madden, I don't expect you to be real familiar with Wisconsin politics, but Steve Kagan getting elected in that seat, that was, as I said, that's a fairly conservative or has traditionally been a fairly conservative part of Wisconsin. And it was a surprise to some that he got elected in the first place, but he's managed to hold the seat. There were some there are a lot of sound bites out on the internet of some of his town meetings on the healthcare issue, but apparently at least still has one strong supporter in Amy from Green Bay.
Yeah, and those are the types of seats that the Democrats are likely to be the most concerned about, is the seats that, that traditionally would be Republican held, and those are the seats that as voters tired of Republicans during especially during the second term of the Bush administration, those are the types of seats that Democrats are able to win, sort of by offering themselves as pragmatic and competent and non-ideological, sort of the complete antidote to the problems that a lot of voters saw with the Bush administration and with Republican rule in Congress, and that's what some Democrats are concerned that they'll have a tough time maintaining that brand is with voters worrying about things like the deficit and sort of the high unemployment remaining an issue. Those are the types of seats that Democrats may have to work harder than they have in the last two elections to hold on to, especially if Republicans are able to nominate credible candidates to challenge them.
Well, that would be the issue, is candidate recruitment, and that would be a question for the Republicans. So far, it looks, from the news that I've been seeing, it looks like they've got a lot of people who want to run. I guess we'll just have to see what kind of candidates they become. We have a number of callers who want to go back and talk about the security issues as applied to politics. So let's we'll go ahead and take some calls on that. We'll start with Ken in Milwaukee.
Hi. Question for you, please. I got an email about an executive order 12-425, and you get a lot of emails. So I did an internet search on whitehouse.gov, and in fact, the president did sign this executive order. And from what I can discern in researching this a little bit, what this executive order does is it allows Interpol pretty much unlimited search and seizure here in the United States, eliminating many of our constitutional protections. And I'm wondering, do you know anything about this, and how come there has been no press about this at all that I've heard?
I'm not that familiar with it. I've heard, I've seen some chatter on some blogs about it, but before the Christmas break came up, I was sort of immersed 100% in healthcare. This order, I see, was issued on December 17th, so I think that I apologize for not following it that closely when it came out, but that was sort of right in the thick of the healthcare debate in the Senate. It's hard to tell from reading it exactly what it does. It's only a paragraph long, so I guess I would just, pleading ignorance, I would still add as a caveat, sometimes these executive orders are harder to harder to make out what they actually do than they appear on the face of it. I would say maybe do a little more research to be sure that that's what it says. But it certainly sounds like something I ought to look into a little bit more. Thanks for bringing it up.
And that may come up again next week. Please continue to remind us to look into that, because that would be a rather serious issue. Let's go next to Dave in Madison. Dave, good morning.
Good morning. A couple things. First of all, us Tea Party goers, we're constitutionalists. We're not teabaggers. Teabaggers is a very derogatory term, and if you don't know the terms that you're using to describe people, maybe you should look it up. And second off, Barry Jarrett, who was in charge of the White House Security Party, who let two gatecrashers get within killing distance of the second most populous country leader in the world, And the best she's ever came up with is she's a lottery ball plucker from Illinois that are friends with the president. Now, the question I have for your guest, and I know which way he leans, he stated at the beginning of the show that the Republicans were going to use a fundraiser from the failed bombing of the airplane. I don't remember seeing that. I wish he could explain it instead of just coming up with these facts that prove his side better than the other.
Well, first of all, it's Desiree Rogers, I think, is the person you're thinking of with the holiday parties. Valerie Jarrett is a domestic policy official. You're thinking of the White House Social Secretary, and I have here an item from The Hill from the day before New Year's Eve, where the National Republican Senatorial Committee sent out a fundraising email talking about how this failed attack is another reason to elect Republicans. We have the executive director of the NRSC, Rob Jesmer, saying, even more scary was knowing this country was one faulty detonator away from an American airliner being blown out of the sky. Remember, right after the inauguration, it was revealed President Obama no longer wanted to acknowledge the global war on terror and referred to terrorist acts as man-made disasters? Back then, you and I knew that showed a remarkable lack of understanding of the threat America faced, but in the face of what nearly happened a couple days ago, it is even more infuriating. So that's, you know, that I didn't make it up. That's a fundraising email attacking the president on national security issues.
Okay, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We have lines available for you right now if you want to get in on all things political. 800-642-1234. You can also use our email address, which is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Either way, you can get your question or comment on the air if you get a hold of us right now. 800-642-1234. My guest is Mike Madden, who is the Washington correspondent for Salon.com. He's with us for about the next 20 minutes or so, and we'll be answering your questions and making comments and giving his insights. He's in Washington and gets to see the game close up. All of these issues are debated in Congress and on elsewhere in our nation's capital. So he's in a position to know a lot of stuff that maybe we don't know. Lots of issues still to be discussed, and we will do that. We're going to take a short break here in just a moment. And when we come back, we'll take some more phone calls and we'll talk about some additional issues. There has been increased suicide bombing activity in both Pakistan and in Afghanistan. This morning, a news story of more American servicemen killed in a suicide bombing attack in Afghanistan. That will be an ongoing issue politically as the year unfolds. Perhaps you'd like to comment on that. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll go ahead and take a break, and when we come back, we'll have more with Mike Madden and your phone calls. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn today. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Kathleen will be back tomorrow morning. Here's what's coming up next hour. New rules go into effect for credit cards in February as part of the Credit Card Act of 2009. And in my next hour, my guest and I will discuss the changes. We've got an expert in banking law coming in to explain it all to us. Lots of stuff to talk about there. In the meantime, we'll continue with all things political here in this 9 o'clock hour of the Kathleen Dunn program. My guest, Mike Madden, Washington correspondent for Salon.com. He joins me by phone, and so does Jeff in Superior. Let's take that call. Jeff, good morning.
Yes, good morning. I wish you a happy new year.
You too.
I'm really excited that we're having discussions politically on both sides of the spectrum and on the airwaves. And I wonder if your guest agrees with this perspective that we can be critical of people we actually support. For example, my congressman is the head of the House Appropriations Committee, Dave Obey, and I've been quite critical of him and his career, but I've always voted for him. And I might think Obama, for example, whom I also voted for, could be doing a better job on certain issues, but I would certainly vote for him again based on his overall job performance. Do you think that can be part of ways that we can improve the dumbing of America, that we could actually be critical of people that we would actually vote for because we think it moves our country in a better direction?
I certainly agree with that, and I think that, unfortunately, many of my colleagues in the media sometimes seem to forget that, you know, that there's this frequent tendency to declare the sky falling for the administration over the last year whenever anyone on the left comes out with anything vaguely critical, and of course there are plenty of people that will be critical, in part because they support the president and they want him to be doing more to act on behalf of the shared values that they have with him. So yes, I certainly agree with you.
Thanks, Jeff, for that call. Before we go to our next call, the irony here is, for me, looking at, say, the last 10 years, the last 20 years, looking at how both parties have seen that trying to run government based strictly on ideology is a losing proposition, and yet we continue to have people who insist that that's the way it's done, where you had the Republican purists insisting that, certain things be done in a certain way, no matter what the pragmatic considerations might be. Now you have the Democratic base, some of them, particularly those out on the left, insisting the same thing from the other direction. Didn't they learn anything from the last 10 years?
Well, I mean, I think that that's... We were talking earlier about some of the interesting conflicts among the Republicans, and I think this is sort of the counterpoint there. This is an interesting contrast among Democrats, where you've got some great divisions among Democrats over specifically over the health care bill, where there are many people saying, look, we need to just pass something. There's significant improvements in this health care bill over the status quo, and the votes simply aren't there to do anything more. And then you have equally passionate Democrats and activists saying no, the Congress and the president should push for the strongest bill, regardless of whether it's immediately politically feasible, and people thinking that the administration and the congressional leaders haven't done enough to explore unconventional options and strategies for passing legislation. I think it's a natural tension in coalitions as broad as U.S. political parties are. I mean, the Democratic Party, just among elected members of the Senate who caucus with the Democrats, you have, as I was talking about before, you have Bernie Sanders, who is a former socialist from Vermont, and then you have someone like Joe Lieberman, who campaigned for John McCain last year for president, and yet they both fit somehow within the broad umbrella of the Senate Democratic Caucus. So it's, that's kind of always the way that political parties work, I guess, is when you only have two. there's a lot of variation in, among them as well as between them.
Let's take a call from Paul in Duluth next. Paul, good morning.
Hi. I know you're trying to do a rapid fire here, but I wanted to inform Dave from Madison, I guess it was, about the campaign letters. The one that I heard about was Congressman Pete Hoekstra from Michigan, who is planning on running against the incumbent Democrat, sent out a similar fundraising appeal, just to correct that. But I have a question. Are you familiar with Michelle Bachmann, who's a congresswoman from Minnesota? She's made quite a name for herself in the last year trying to out Sarah Palin. And I just can't believe that the people in Minnesota would reelect her. I wonder, I'll take your answer off the air. I wonder if you know anything about that. Thank you.
That's a good question. That's a good way of putting a description of Michelle Bachmann, that she's trying to out Sarah Palin. I certainly am familiar with her. It's hard to cover politics and not be familiar with her, and we at Salon have written about her pretty frequently. She's made some fairly inflammatory statements over the last couple of years, not just this past year, but has really been out in front of some of the Tea Party movement as far as elected officials go. Her district is an interesting one. It sort of spans some of the exurbs of the Twin Cities and then further out into rural Minnesota. Democrats had tried in the last election to target her, and they didn't have much luck, even though she was famously recorded on Hardball last year, or 2 years ago now, in 2008, claiming that there were un-American members of Congress. And you would have thought that would have given people pause as they went to vote and sort of wondered you know, would make them wonder, okay, is this woman really being responsible with the facts, and do we really want her representing us? But the Democrats weren't able to dislodge her. So you may see them making another effort this year. But she's certainly made a name for herself and has probably got access now to pretty deep fundraising networks and a lot of passionate support. So it may be harder to get her out now.
Well, there's a fairly significant segment of the population for whom being criticized by Keith Olbermann would be a badge of honor.
Absolutely, that's certainly true. And the more she provokes outrage among Democrats, the more she provokes admiration among her supporters.
Let's take a call from Fred in Wisconsin Rapids next. Fred, good morning.
Hi, good morning, guys. Me and my wife were kind of amused this last week when we heard on the Heidi Collins show on CNN referring to it as the lost decade, and yet there's no mention of it or tie-in to the Bush administration that was in power for 8 years during the lost decade, and where we've lost our jobs, we've had the Iraq War, we've had the financial crisis. You can just go on and on and on, and I'm just surprised that there's no tie-in. That's my comment.
Well, thanks for the call. I mean, I think that's something that you'll see Democrats trying to remind voters of this year as well. I mean, you know, regardless of how people may feel about the Obama administration, they've still only been in office for a year now, and it'll be still less than 2 years by the time the elections come around. And so there may still be some political mileage to be had in reminding people of who got the country into the mess it's in the first place. And the administration and a lot of Democrats will say, well, look, you know, we may not have fixed things quickly enough for you, but look at what we were dealing with when we first came in. I don't know how persuasive that's going to be since Democrats have controlled Congress for 4 years now and the administration will be halfway through the first term. They'll certainly give it a try, and there are certainly plenty of people out there who do feel that this is all something that started under Bush, and that it's unfair to lay all the blame for it at the feet of his successor.
Well, you know, I would think that for some people, and I've heard this in conversations, for some people, what's becoming apparent is that no one can get anything done. I mean, it doesn't matter who's in power because they can't work together enough to get anything done that has any real meaning. And basically, you have a bunch of people who are mostly focused on power and trying to score points off the other side. And for the more cynical among us, it may be an excuse to say, you know what, the heck with all of you, I'm just going to sit this out.
Yeah, and I think that's the risk that's the risk that that Democrats are particularly aware of is you know that the harder it is to legislate, the harder it is to motivate people to stay engaged in the political process. I mean, this has not been a year that's really, I mean, even as someone who is interested in politics and who follows it professionally and who would follow it even if it wasn't my job to follow it, it's not really been a year that you know, 2009 was not really a year that would make you think, gee, this political system works just wonderfully, and I can't wait to participate in it further in the future. I mean, it's you know, every step has been very difficult. I think that you know that's something Democrats are going to have to try to figure out how to surmount, and I'm not sure that they'll be able to entirely. It's the way the system's set up maybe breeds more cynicism than people might like.
Let's go to Bob in Appleton next. Bob, good morning.
Good morning. For the life of me, I can't figure out when we're going to get our government back from all the dodos that are elected in Washington. It's supposed to be a government of, by, and for the people, not for the Republicans, not for the Democrats, and not for the people who are hammering hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars into their campaign funds. It's supposed to be of, by, and for the people. Now, when they're running in primaries, they can argue all they want against the other party. But when they're in government, they're supposed to work together to make the government run. And if they can't do that, they ought to leave. Because this is, like I said, it's a government of, by, and for the people, not the Republicans, not the Democrats, not the independents, oh, geez, they had to give that one woman $480 million for her district to get by her vote, just to buy a vote so they could get that health care thing through. Now, to me, that's totally ridiculous, and that is bribery, and they ought to be brought up on charges.
Bob, I think, was evincing the sentiments that I was describing just a moment ago. The government, people are elected. They're supposed to be governing.
Yeah, that's right. It's as if he called in right on cue there. I mean, I think that's like I was saying, it's easy to look at things and feel fairly disgusted by them. On the other hand, it's hard to change them if you just kind of sit out and say, well, you know, a pox on both your houses. You can't really effectively pressure politicians if you don't get involved in the system. So.
Well, is there an opportunity for other parties to get involved, for new parties to form, if the two major parties just continually prove that the only thing they know about government is that they can't run it? Is there a chance for a third party to pop up and say, hey, you know, pay attention, we're for something else?
You know, you'd think there might be, but actually, unfortunately, this is. You know, maybe one of the reasons that the cynicism is sometimes well-founded. It's very difficult to dislodge incumbent members of Congress, regardless of what party they're in, and it's especially difficult to do it if you don't have the resources of the other major political party backing you. I mean, it's you know, the House districts are drawn basically by the political parties themselves, depending on who controls the state house in states. And, you know, there's a handful of states that use nonpartisan commissions to draw the districts, but essentially the politicians pick the voters that they want, and then they go out and run for re-election in front of a district whose demographics they've tailored to suit themselves. You know, it's not impossible, and I don't want to rule it out totally out of hand, but it's incredibly difficult. You know, it will be very difficult for a third party to become a major force just because the two parties are so entrenched at this point.
One of the things, the issues we haven't gotten to politically and continues to be a big political issue in Washington and across the country is health care. I want to spend the last few minutes of our hour today talking about the health care debate. The Senate, just before Christmas, managed to pass a health care bill. Now it's at the point where they're reconciling between the House and Senate. Handicap this for us a little bit. What's going to be what's next for the health care bill, and what's your take on what's likely to come out of this? We've already started to see Democrats backing away, Democrats in the House backing away from the public option, for example. What's the most likely scenario on health care moving forward here?
Well, I think it's extremely likely that something passes and gets signed into law. I think that the Democrats learned their lesson from the 94 election, which was that the only thing worse than passing a health care bill that can be characterized as unpopular would be to spend the better part of the year debating an unpopular health care bill and then wind up not having anything to show for it. So I think that, you know, that there's certainly a desire on the part of Democratic leaders in the House and the Senate and the White House to finish this process up and get something passed. As far as what that something is likely to look like, you know, I think that for better or for worse, the moderates in the Senate and the conservatives in the Senate have sort of seized control of the negotiating process, and it seems fairly clear that. That something that's significantly different from the Senate bill won't be able to pass, and I think that, you know, the House may wind up essentially having to swallow the broad outlines of the Senate bill, which would probably mean the public option is jettisoned. But you know, Senate sources were telling me after the Senate passed its bill that there are certainly some features of the House bill that would make the overall package more attractive. You know, that they may. Try to beef up the subsidies that the government would give to people that can't afford insurance so that the overall insurance package is more affordable. They may attempt to make the bill take effect a little bit sooner so that people can see some more tangible benefits from the legislation sometime before it was scheduled to take effect. I mean, the original draft would in the Senate, it wouldn't actually become law until 2014. So, you know, I think you'll probably see... something like the Senate bill. So you'll have, you know, exchanges set up for people that can't get insurance through their jobs. Their insurance plans will be subsidized by the government on a sliding scale, depending on how much money they make. You'll see some insurance regulatory reforms and, you know, a handful of cost-saving, cost-cutting measures, although, you know, maybe not as many as people might have hoped. If you had said 3 years ago that that was going to be coming to the desk of the president sometime in 2010, a lot of people might have said, gee, we'll take it. And I think, you know, unfortunately, the process has been pretty hard to getting there, and it's what started out fairly progressive has been watered down pretty heavily along the way, so there's a sense of disappointment. But I think that they're likely to move something in that direction sometime fairly soon.
And that's a good place for us to leave it. Mike Madden, thanks for joining us this hour.
Thanks for having me.
Mike Madden is Washington correspondent for Salon.com. Rob Ferret produced this hour. Rachel Owens handled on-air production. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. We've got another hour. We're talking credit cards after the news. Stay tuned. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.